Everybody, we're going to begin the House Judiciary Committee hearing on this Friday afternoon. I appreciate members that we've tried to avoid Fridays when possible, and given our bill load and workload at this point, it just looks like we've got to probably count on some Friday meetings. I'll also let you know that we're talking about the possibility of maybe having some evening meetings, which may be a better way to do it as we move into the busier time of our schedule. So why don't we go ahead and get started, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2118. Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, House Bill
2118.
House Bill 2118 deals with the statutes involving what are known as PIN registers and trap and trace devices. Real quickly, these are two items or devices that allow for recording of phone numbers, and they are a court order can be issued based upon probable cause of certain crimes being committed or about to be committed. Law enforcement can get an order to use these devices to monitor the phone numbers that come in and out of certain person's phone, and this bill in sections 1 and 2 would allow that to get that to use for identity theft, or excuse me, for RICO violations. RICO is the statute that is mentioned in Section 1 and Section 2 ORS 166720. Real quickly, racketeering is what RICO is, and that statute references the what are termed as racketeering activities. So essentially would allow use of these devices to investigate such a crime.
Okay, thank you, counsel. We're going to start out with Matthew McCauley from the Oregon Department of Justice and Eric Wassman from the Oregon Department of Justice.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Matthew McCauley. I'm an Assistant Attorney General of the Oregon Department of Justice, the Criminal Justice Division, and the Organized Crime Section. As has been stated, this bill proposes to add racketeering to the list of crimes which a PIN register or a trap trace may be authorized by court order. And there's also been pretty much set out a PIN register and or a trap trace that's right now set forth in ORS 165657. It's a means of tracking and recording incoming and outgoing phone numbers being called to a target number. So generally, the court order would identify a particular target order, a target number, and then they would track all phone calls made from that target number, and identify those phone numbers, and they would track the phone numbers calling into that target number. A trap trace or a PIN register generally collects information of the target number. They also associate a criminal case number to that, the date of the call, the time of the call, the duration of the call, whether the call was dialed in or out. It also will give you city, state, and country information based on the phone number itself. And they can also can tell the general location based on, if it's a cell phone, based on the cell tower and or the associated switch for the target phone. PIN registers and trap traces do not record or listen to conversations. This is only dealing with phone numbers. By statute, these are limited to 30-day increments, and it happens in real time. And so the police investigating the case who have a PIN register or trap trace are able to make determinations of the phone numbers as those calls are being made. Racketeering is, of course, found at ORS 166715. Just as a reminder to the committee, RICO is a complex criminal statute. It's not just a single criminal act, but it requires at least two predicate crimes, which are enumerated in the statute. It's not just any old crime, but certain limited crimes. Those are enumerated. If two or more of those crimes are committed and the commission of those crimes have the same or similar intents, results, accomplices, victims, or methods of commission, and there is an associated enterprise, and those two crimes and the people involved with those crimes have a nexus to the enterprise, then we have a RICO offense. Because they are very complex in nature, relatively speaking, RICO offenses are not charged very often in the state. However, the RICO statute was created because organized criminal activity creates special prosecutorial and investigative challenges. When looking at these general areas, and I've outlined them in the written testimony, I'd just like to just chat briefly about the kinds of crimes and why we have an interest in changing the trap, trace, and PIM register law. I've just kind of grouped these as terrorism, child porn rings, organized crime groups, and white-collar crime groups and conspiracies. These are types of crime that the state has an interest in prosecuting that would be, generally speaking, cases in which we would be bringing RICO cases, but for also which don't typically or don't always involve crimes that are set out and listed currently in the statute, which are already enumerated on my written testimony. In terrorism, in fact, in all of these, money laundering, which gives the criminal organization the ability to take the proceeds from the criminal operation and either hide it, conceal it, or fund, continuing to fund, the criminal operation. That is a crime that is typically committed by all these types of organized crime. It is a crime for which we cannot currently get pen register or trap trace information. And terrorism is a broad category. Of course, there's international terrorism, funding of international terrorism, there's domestic terrorism. In that group, the Department of Justice typically includes large organized hate groups. These are sometimes, you know, I guess common affiliations for these are the skinheads and diverse neo-Nazi organizations. Those groups that conduct actual terrorist operations for the purpose of doing that fall into organized crime. And so you see money laundering, charity scams, cigarette smuggling, ID theft, forgery, racial intimidation, criminal mischief, assault, and significantly firearms trafficking and other firearms offenses, which includes possession and manufacture of machine guns, short-barreled firearms, and silencers. None of those crimes are included in the current trap, trace, pen register bill, in the current statute. Furthermore, Oregon and the Northwest in particular have a problem with what's been termed eco-terrorism or eco-terrorism. These groups with a criminal agenda have, and we really want to make a distinction between people who are exercising, obviously, they're, you know, we don't, it's not a criminal act just to be involved in having environmental concerns and you're doing First Amendment types of things based on those concerns, but eco-terrorism is the criminal acts concerned with organized efforts to push that agenda. That has in Oregon involved serious issues of burglary, criminal mischief. There are episodes of tree spiking and all these things which would not fall under necessarily what is already in the statute. Another serious concern to the Department of Justice is our child porn rings. These concern felonies and misdemeanors, but especially felonies that do not appear in the current trap, trace, pen register statute. Why these are a particular concern is that the need to get connecting information to connect all the people involved in such a porn ring and prosecute them and catch them all at one time becomes a serious matter, because an ongoing criminal episode involved in a child porn ring is victimizing multiple victims over a period of time, and waiting to get information after the fact simply means additional harm has been done to the individual. These crimes would include sex abuse, use of a child in display, sex display of an act, rape, child abuse, and money laundering. Organized crime groups, I've kind of grouped these all together. There are a variety. These can run the gamut from just mere groups of people that get together and form a criminal enterprise to ethnically based criminal organizations. As funding for these operations, it is known that in Oregon and in other states, these groups will engage in organized auto theft, what we typically call chop shops, prostitution, prostitution rings, ID theft, forgery, burglary. It is known that in Oregon as well as other states and internationally, these groups participate in wide-scale cigarette smuggling and unlawful distribution of cigarettes, which is aimed primarily at robbing the state of its tax income. Alien smuggling, gun running, alcohol running, all these things are connected with organized crime in its kind of generic, general sense. And none of those things are we able to use the investigative tool of a trap trace or pin register on right now. I'd just like to spend 1 minute talking about general white-collar crime and conspiracies, which generally focus on financial, large-scale financial crimes. These are familiar nowadays typically as securities and securities fraud, but they can take the form of just embezzlement, theft, forgery, and those types of things. In prosecuting these cases, probably the most difficult aspect for a prosecutor to deal with is that the damages done in a single episode by a single criminal organization are tremendous. I think that most racketeering cases in this genre that I prosecuted either at the county level or that I've been involved with at the state level have included or involved millions and millions of dollars. I have never seen any of that money repaid in restitution orders. The reason I'm bringing that up is although restitution is a means of, on paper, trying to make a financial crime equal, I know of multiple victims, single victims, who have had in a financial crime or securities crime lost $500,000 to $1 million of usually retirement income that they can't afford to lose and never recoup. And so the ability to interdict the criminal operation while it is occurring instead of waiting for it to cease and then get information can literally mean the difference of hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars to the victim. That really is the impetus, is we'd like to be able to get involved in organized crimes cases while they are going on and prevent additional harm from happening in these important cases, from terrorism, child porn, to embezzlement and securities fraud. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the Department of Justice understands that there is opposition to this bill. We are very willing to meet with anybody opposing this bill to discuss a middle ground with them, and would be pleased to return to the committee offering any alternatives to this that we are able to come up with.
Thank you.
General Leib, I have nothing to add.
Nothing to add. Okay. Are there questions for these gentlemen? Representative Przanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McCauley, Eric, thank you for being here. I've got to ask a question as to where are we going with the RICO. I mean, it seems like every session where we have requests to include more and more crimes to go underneath there. When I look at the list now, it looks like we're somewhere in the range of about 54 different crimes. With this request, I understand what we're looking at doing is opening up the use of pin registers or trap traces for any of those crimes that would meet the definition of RICO. Is that correct?
In a general, yes. In a general sense, a RICO crime is its own crime. But the predicate acts that make up a RICO involves a very large list of crimes. And, yes, at its broadest, that could include any RICO predicate act.
And that's what I guess I'd like for you to maybe walk us through, in the sense of when I look at the list of the crimes that are currently on the RICO list, are we saying that we're going to require or have some type of probable cause that two of those predicates have actually been documented or have proof before, or would be able to go to the judge and ask the judge for this type of trace or trap?
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, the way this would work under the statute is that law enforcement would have to make out probable cause and affidavit to a judge that a RICO had been committed. So probable cause for the racketeering would include not only probable cause for two or more of the crimes, but probable cause that those crimes are linked and that those crimes and the people involved in those crimes are have a nexus to an enterprise, and probable cause that that enterprise is engaged in the crime. So it's actually a much more difficult proposition than simply proving probable cause on two individual crimes.
If I may, Chair Williams and Representative Przanski, the standard actually, as set out in the statute and in the bill, would be that the state would be required to show probable cause to believe that an individual is committing, has committed, or is about to commit a particular crime, a felony, and then listing out and under this proposal would include RICO. But with a crime as complex as RICO, the about to commit language would probably be very difficult to meet in most instances, since the state would be required to show somehow, if we're talking prospectively, the state would have to show that the person was about to create an enterprise, about to engage in pattern racketeering activity that consisted of at least two predicates. So generally speaking, for practical terms, I'm really not sure how the state would meet this standard prospectively if the crime that it was investigating was RICO. So I think the state would actually have to be able to show the existence of already committed predicate acts, the existence currently of an enterprise, and the nexus to the enterprise, those things.
Thank you for putting that on the record.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Anders.
While I am personally in favor of these kinds of things, I'm sure there are folks that view this as an intrusion on their privacy. Are there any provisions for sunsetting things like this so that when the terrorism is over, for instance, foreign terrorism, that some of these things can be dropped back out again?
Chair Williams, Representative Anderson, I'm not aware that the Legislative Assembly has chosen to put a sunset on any one of the various forms of electronic surveillance authority that it has given to law enforcement. And I think particularly in this area, while terrorism may or may not be a temporary threat, there never seems to be any absence of organized crime in a variety of ways. And what we're actually seeing is the growth of organized crime into new and different areas. For example, 10 years ago, I don't think any of us would have come into a room and talked about such a thing as a pornography ring, those kinds of things. Many of these forms of organized crime are brand new to us, and so that is part of the impetus here.
Mm-hmm. Gentlemen, I'm struck just by the looking at the current law that allows you to do trap and trace, focusing primarily on the dangerous crimes that it identifies, and then also the drug crime area in that 400 series of statutes. And then, as Representative Przanski has pointed out, and I think most of us on this committee have been willing participants in the expansion of potential RICO issues, Representative Chatterley is the father of many rivers on agricultural issues that we added in the last session. And as I go down the list, some of them appear to be right in line with exactly what you're saying, that they, in my mind, they would be absolutely appropriate to be included in a list of trap trace kinds of crimes. And others I look at and I have a bit more concern about, things like relating to branch banking or relating to credit unions or some things like that I have a harder time relating to riot, harder to figure out exactly how you fit that into the same sort of crimes that have been previously identified as a matter of policy. And so I guess I'm just interested generally about your thoughts about that. I think there are even some relating to interference with legislative operations, is that it allows me to do trap
trace.
I was going to say that it allows me to trap trace on most of the lobby in the building, it seems to me. I think that that was especially for the communications people on the back wall. I'm hoping you pick that up. So I guess I'm just interested in your thoughts about your sense of just picking up the RICO statutes en masse by the reference, or if you think that there is some logical analysis of which of those statutes ought to be pulled in, given your, sort of the definitional information that you provided. And either one of you can respond. It's just sort of more of a curious question for me.
Okay. I'm going to take a shot at that first.
Chair Williams, we have not gone through that analysis, and perhaps the reason why is because, in our view, racketeering, which involves a criminal enterprise and interaction among individuals, by its nature, is the kind that really calls for the ability to gather information about the communication among the people who are in the enterprise. And so we had not really focused on the predicate crimes, because to us the important part of racketeering is that you have an ongoing criminal enterprise that is engaging in criminal conduct of a variety of kinds. I would say I have not seen a racketeering charge in which we had two or more predicates of interfering with legislative activity. Generally speaking, we have in almost every racketeering charge predicates that were serious enough to gather the attention of law enforcement and prosecutors in their own right. And so it would seem to us that if the legislature has decided that this crime is important enough to form a predicate for the racketeering statute, then law enforcement would need to have the ability to gather information about the communications between the people who make up the criminal enterprise engaged in that pattern of racketeering activity.
I think, Chair Williams, that the there are, and as I mentioned at the close of my comments, there is absolutely some middle ground that we are willing to discuss about, and I believe that would be relatively easy to craft, choosing specific predicate acts or specific types of predicate acts to include in this bill. There are several different ways that pie can be sliced. You can limit predicate acts that are felonies. You can limit predicate acts by type, such as sex related crimes, or crimes that would be user involved and delineated as some type of terrorism type crime. But I think that there's a lot of room to move in that,
sure,
seeing how there's so many crimes.
In part, my question was anticipatory, given the testimony that I think we're going to hear after you guys come down off the panel. But it is interesting, if you haven't, colleagues, sort of looked at the predicate crimes under 166, I'll pass them around, and you can take a look at the... Are they all listed in the next bill? Well, that's how convenient. So you can just read them out of the next bill, then, if you want to look at them. But, I mean, it's a long list, and it's interesting to consider, how that might, in fact, be useful. And I don't think any of us were probably here when the initial list was constructed as to trap trace or what the rationale was as to what was included and for what purpose. And so it is going to be something that I think we're going to want to think about. Anything else? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, call up David Bedanke and Kelly Sky. And I hope you don't mind coming up together. Is that all right? If you do, you can sit with the chair in between the two of you and have to sit right next to each other.
No, you go.
Are you sure you don't want to go? Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, David Fidanke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon. And as you know, Mr. Chair, and I think most of the other members of the committee know, I'm not an attorney. I'm certainly not an expert on trap and trace or wiretapping, but I just want to try to put this in a little bit broader perspective, as some of the committee members pointed out, and as you pointed out, Mr. Chair, there are numerous crimes included in the racketeering statute. And while I would certainly recognize that the Attorney General's office and most district attorneys around the state have been very judicious in their use of the racketeering statute, at least as far as prosecutions is concerned, we're very concerned about this bill creating an exception that would swallow the rule. Because as you focused in on the language in Section 1 of the bill, current RS 165.663, this allows issuing of orders when a crime is about to be committed. In a normal search situation, and the ACLU would maintain that this is a search and a seizure of private information, the government must have a warrant that states specifically the things to be seized. In this case, and in the case of wiretaps, the reason that legislatures in the past and the federal government have put a higher bar on wiretaps and pen registers and trap and trace is that they sweep in much innocent activity in order to find a little bit of illegal activity, or in some cases a lot of illegal activity. In the wiretap situation, we know that, you know, literally thousands of hours of conversations are listened in on and recorded that are perfectly innocent for in order to find a few minutes that indicates criminal activity. This is that type of dragnet approach. It obviously has great utility for law enforcement, but general searches always have great utility for law enforcement. The ones we hear about coming to court are the ones where they found evidence of criminal activity. We don't hear about the activity that did not disclose criminal activity and the innocent people's privacy who was subject to government scrutiny. We believe that's the reason that the list of crimes in RRS 165.663 was very limited. It was a conscious choice in order to protect the privacy of innocent individuals who may have some tangential contact with another individual who is a criminal suspect. And so I think, you know, the policy choice you have is how high should that bar be? Do you care about the privacy of innocent people being invaded by the government in order to catch a few of the guilty? And we would maintain that you should care very much about the privacy rights of those innocent individuals that you will and the courts will likely never hear about, but who may be subject to criminal investigation because they made a phone call to a particular person that was subject to one of these orders. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Fedenke. Kelly.
Good afternoon, Chair Williams, members of the committee. I'm Kelly Skye, legislative representative for Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and our association opposes this bill for many of the reasons that have already been stated by Mr. Fedenke, Representative Williams, and Representative Przanski, and that is that the RICO statute is extremely broad. The number of predicate offenses, as Chair Williams pointed out, includes activity as minimal as criminal trespass. So if you have an organization that could be engaging in peaceful protest, which frequently results in arrests for criminal trespass, organizations such as that could be swallowed into being subject to a pen register or trap and trace device. And therein lie our concerns, both with the invasion of privacy and the ability of the state to investigate organizations that would not otherwise be deemed to be criminal. And I think that it's important to note that the trap and trace statute, these crimes that are delineated are crimes that are dangerous to life and punishable as a felony. And as you've noted, this will expand it to a full list of crimes. And we, too, are open to limiting the predicate crimes that would apply in the trap and trace expansion to those that are felonies. That may take care of part of our concerns, but it is a very broad expansion of this trap and trace and pen register provision. The other concern that hasn't been brought up is that today the state of technology is such that trap and traces and pen registers may apply to a more expansive area than just telephones. And so we just feel that if you are going to expand the ability and make it easier to get orders for trap and traces or pen registers, that it's something that you not do without putting a great deal of thought into it and really analyzing exactly what it is that you're allowing, because it's easy to throw racketeering into the statute without understanding what all you're throwing into it.
Thank you, both of you. We'll open it up for questions. I guess, Kelly, my question is, and I think I heard you say this, it isn't going to be your position or your organization's position that they would oppose any expansion, or would you have to oppose any expansion of trap and trace?
I always get put in this situation where my organization tells me one position, and then I'm asked, well, what would your position be on this? And without being able to go back and consult with the organization, you know, I'll be honest that one of the things that we considered in looking at this bill is that when the legislature passed Senate Bill 936, which expanded the admissibility of evidence in criminal proceedings, it basically did away with statutory suppression. So a violation of this statute is not necessarily going to mean that the illegally obtained evidence will be suppressed in that criminal proceeding. So it's not going to have a huge effect on the actual criminal proceedings which are issued. The bigger effect is, as Mr. Fedanke mentioned, on those people who were investigated and not subjected to criminal prosecution. And in light of that, I would say that we would be supportive of any narrowing of this. But
still likely take a final position in opposition of the bill.
Right.
Okay. David?
Ditto.
Yeah. Okay. That's sort of what I thought. All right. But I just wanted to make it clear. Questions by the committee? All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2118. And I think that it would be my preference to give the committee a little bit of time to think about your thoughts around whether or not you believe narrowing in some way from the broad RICO implications to, you know, some more definable methodology would be the committee's preference. You know, that's something that we can talk about, or I can send a note around, or if you want to communicate with me or Mr. Prinz about that issue, and then we'll bring the bill back. So with that, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2119. And I would ask counsel to explain it. And while you're explaining it, Cheryl Pellegrini and Karen, Pfeiffer, I'm sorry. You let Cheryl sign in for you, and I can't read her writing. Am I right? Oh, no, I can't read your writing. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this bill, as you've probably seen in looking at it, would add identity theft to the RICO predicate offenses.
Okay. Cheryl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini. I work for the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm an assistant attorney general, currently serving as attorney in charge of the department's financial fraud consumer protection section. We enforce the state's consumer protection laws, antitrust laws, and we also enforce civil RICO provisions. A couple of comments at the outset. I would note that this particular bill, House Bill 2119, targets what we're trying to get at is enterprises or collections of individuals as opposed to individual defendants that commit the crime of identity theft. I say that because I think that this committee may have heard another bill, Senate Bill 52, which also has to do with identity theft and provides for enhanced penalties in the prosecution of individual defendants.
We have, it's that bill, just so you know, Cheryl, is still in the Senate. So
I'm sorry.
It hasn't come into our possession yet.
I'm sorry. My apologies. You may hear of it then. House Bill 2119 is actually one of three bills that have been introduced by Attorney General Myers targeting identity theft. The other two bills, one of which you have heard, House Bill 2103, it's a prevention bill, and that would require the obliteration of information on credit card receipts. There's House Bill 2105, which would provide for free credit reports to Oregonians. And then both of those are prevention bills. And then there's this bill, which makes up the third. And this bill would put a significant tool in the hands of law enforcement to pursue and stop identity thieves. I'm just going to highlight some of the written testimony that I provide, and I'm not going to read it. The fact that identity theft is not currently a predicate offense for Oregon's Racketeering and Influence and Corrupt Organizations Act may be more a matter of timing than anything else. And I'm not going to go through explaining our RICO. Mr. McCauley gave a very good and comprehensive description of that. I would only note that RICO also provides for civil prosecution as well as criminal prosecution, and that would be the interest of my section. RICO was originally adopted in 1981. At that time, identity theft was not a crime in Oregon. It did not become a crime until 1999. It's our view, therefore, that the absence of identity theft from RICO is simply due to the youthfulness of identity theft as a crime. It had not been yet identified. Currently, identity theft is virtually the only theft-related offense under Oregon law that is not included as a predicate offense for RICO. And I footnoted that and said virtually because there is another one I looked before I came in here. ORS 164.065, which is theft of lost or mislaid property, is not a RICO offense, and it may be because the nature of the crime is just not very conducive to organizations or enterprises. What is the current problem and why are we here, really? Well, current problem is identity theft and the fact that it is a burgeoning crime in Oregon. I believe that attached to my written testimony are some statistics that are provided by the Federal Trade Commission for both 2001 and 2002, noting that Oregon in 2001 was ranked seventh among the states, including D.C., for identity theft. There were 1,255 Oregon victims in 2001. In 2002, the number almost doubled. There were 2,200 victims of identity theft. Identity thieves use stolen bank accounts, debit cards, credit cards, and personal information to run up massive debts in the names of innocent Oregonians. They steal much more than the good names of their victims, and Karen Pfeiffer, who is here today, will talk about that a little bit more from a first-person perspective. What they do is they ruin the financial reputation of individuals who have labored for years to build good credit history. The average victim, this again is reported by the Federal Trade Commission, spends at least $1,000 and several years repairing the damage done by identity thieves. Under existing law, police and prosecutors can use the crime of identity theft to pursue individual defendants. Identity theft is a Class B felony. As part of the state's identity theft work group organized by the Department of Motor Vehicles, one thing that was mentioned or addressed in that group is that often identity theft is a symptom of a greater network of illegal activity, and that House Bill 2119 represents the efforts of that group to bolster the ability of criminal and civil law enforcement to reach beyond the individual thief to the larger enterprise that uses identity theft to support other illegal activities. Identity theft is a mobile crime. To identity thieves, personal information is a commodity, and there is an entire national and global market for that information. Personal information stolen from someone in Oregon may be sold several times across both county and state lines. Individual thieves purchase information, run up debt in the name of that person, and then resell the person's name. So that a victim, by the time a victim, or at the point at which a victim finds out that they've been a victim of identity theft, that may not be the end. That may only be the beginning for them. In addition, identity theft, as I've mentioned, it's what we consider to be an enterprise crime, often committed by a group of individuals to generate cash or to accumulate assets to be used in the furtherance of other fraudulent or illegal activities. One thing that we learned from both prosecutors and criminal law enforcement in the ID theft work group that I mentioned is that there appears to be a nexus between identity theft and other organized criminal activities, in particular methamphetamine production and distribution rings and organized counterfeiting rings. Currently, criminal and civil prosecutors have to bring individual actions against each participant in an enterprise, making it difficult to present the entire picture in any single case. Adding identity theft to the list of predicate offenses for RICO will extend the reach of law enforcement to capture all participants of a criminal enterprise, and it will also allow us to present the complete and comprehensive picture of illegal activity. Under Oregon RICO, criminal prosecutors and civil prosecutors have the ability to aggregate separate instances of identity theft. More importantly for us, as civil prosecutors, it would allow us to not only identify all of the participants, but also would allow us to be able to identify any assets that those participants have amassed and to be able to seek the civil forfeiture of those assets and the return of property to victims. Finally, it would allow us to seek the dissolution of corporations that were formed in connection with an illegal enterprise. For all of these reasons, we would ask the committee to seriously consider this bill, and we would ask that you pass it from this committee with a due pass recommendation to the floor. If you have any questions, actually, perhaps it might be more appropriate to turn it over to Karen.
Karen, please.
Okay. My name is Karen Pfeiffer. I'm an administration manager for electronics company in Cornelius. And I was a previous victim and am still a victim of identity theft. It happened in 1999, and it led me on a long path. Well, I'm the person behind HB 3057 because I made a decision to go hiking one day just spontaneously, and that's not like me. I'm not a very spontaneous person. But and I'm paranoid, so I hid my purse in the back of my car under a coat and in the back side of the car so no one would find it, and I was only gone for about 20 minutes. I came back, my window of my car had been smashed in, and my purse had been taken, and it was right after Christmas. It was in January 1999, and unfortunately I had a lot of information about myself and in the purse at that time, and unknowingly they did not take my cell phone, so I already started canceling my bank accounts and credit cards on the way home. And by the time I got home, they'd already used them, and I was described as a black man. And I was kind of surprised, so I called the place where they used the credit card, and I asked them why they accepted that credit card since I'm a female and it's very obvious and he was a man. Well, he had got on the phone and called his wife and kind of gave her this big story in the store, and she bought it. And by that time, I realized that this was serious, so I tried to get, unfortunately, there was a jurisdiction issue going on here. And I live in Washington County, and the crime happened in Multnomah County. And I did file the police report in Washington County. And I was thinking that it was just basically somebody stole my checks, and I was going to have to stop that. Well, that lasted for, they had 9 or 10 checks, and everything was canceled, but they were able to cash checks everywhere. And I called all the corporate headquarters of every place they cashed a check, because it was more than just the fact that the employees were taking this information that had been canceled. That concerned me. But there were several places that they allowed it to happen twice, and I was suspicious that there was a Safeway, and I was suspicious that somebody inside there was operating, because I thought, how could they get away with this twice in one place? And I called Safeway's corporate headquarters, and of course they gave me this big spiel about how terrible theft was for them and how could they keep track of anything. And then I called the police and I asked if I could have a detective assigned to my case, because these people are not stopping. I had to get fraud, affidavits on fraud on every single thing they did. And in addition to that, I got letters from every single company, so I went a little step beyond that. And I was thinking it was going to end after that, and I switched bank accounts. But then I received a phone call, and somebody had bought 6 or 7 cell phones in my name. And they got suspicious because they had them sent to an address in Northeast Portland, which ended up on North Gilbert, which ended up on my credit report right here. And that has been a heck of a time. They tried to actually put their addresses on my credit report. And after that happened, I saw an article in a newspaper called The Crusader, and I picked that up, and I contacted Jerry Levy. And he gave me some ideas about identity theft, because I didn't know anything about it at that time. And he said, you need to put fraud alerts, contact all the credit agencies and put fraud alerts on all of your accounts. He said, obviously you have the type of criminals that are going to keep on going on with this crime. And indeed, that was the case with me. They, just to make a long story short, I am very glad I put the fraud alerts on my account. They tried to rent an apartment in my name, and every single time it was a different person. I would get a description, and I would call the police up, and of course I didn't have a detective assigned at this time. They told me that if I canceled out all my credit cards and I closed out all my accounts, what did I really need them for? They couldn't do anything. And I was really upset with that. I got the names of every police officer, and I told him, well, I think something else needs to be done about this, but I wasn't sure at that time what needed to be done. And it was very frustrating for me, because I actually put up a map on my wall and started tracing where these criminals were hitting, and I found they hit in a certain area, and it was close to Vancouver. And I actually got a call one night. I was at a friend's house, and they were in a jewelry store, and they got them on videotape. And one of the police officers had said that if you send me a videotape, I'll get a detective assigned to your case. So I got the videotape, and I did get a detective assigned to my case. But the detective followed these people around, and he said, Karen, I really can't do anything, because they live in Vancouver, and some of them live in Portland. And every time he got a description, it would be a different person. The people that rented my house, it was a woman with 2 children, and she put a deposit. They tried to rent a house. They put a deposit down, and I thought, well, we can get them now, because I called. They actually faxed me the application to my place of employment because of the fraud alert. I said, no, I live in Hillsboro. I'm not trying to rent this place. But what I can do is, if you can get them to come back, and you can get them, because I was told by the police officer that if they showed my Social Security card and gave false ID to a police officer, that then they could arrest them. And unfortunately, no one showed up. And so I didn't think the police took this seriously enough. And I really realized, because it was a problem that was fairly out of control as I went on further with things that happened to me. And all of these bad things that happened ended up on my credit report. And I was interviewed for the Oregonian, and I'm going to put a quote, is that in the end, the damage done to me financially I could repair, It wasn't fun. It took a lot of my time, practically a year of my time and effort. But to me, the money part of it was nothing. It was my good name, my credit, and my reputation that none of you can put a price on. That was extremely important to me. And at that time, I decided that I would put a bill through the state legislature. However, the police still couldn't get them. The bill went after my crime was done, but they would lived in another place. He said, well, they went over to Vancouver the last time a crime was done to me. And believe me, they tried to do everything they could. I was very, very proactive. I cannot even imagine what would happen to somebody if they weren't proactive as I was, because they actually tried to get a repair done to a house that they were living in and used information that they had in telephone information that they got from probably my purse to call a plumber that I used for my company only. And he was suspicious because he said I acted really strange. And I was calling him to go pretty far away. It was in Vancouver. And so he called me at my office, and I said, well, I don't even need a plumber. And he said, well, somebody just called on my cell phone and requested that I come over to their place. And, of course, I tried to get that information, but he had deleted it from his cell phone. His cell phone deleted the next, because I was going to give that to the police officer, but I did call it in. And so, as you can see, I had a wide range of crimes, different types of crimes, committed from them attempting to rent an apartment in my name, opening up accounts. They went down to California and opened up an account at a jewelry store in California for $150. If you don't think I was tempted to pay that, but that would be admitting that that was my crime. It was only $150. That is still on my credit report in 2002. I just got it off again. I was going for a mortgage, and they go, well, you have an uncollectible on your credit report. And I said, no, I don't. Well, this is after this had been taken off over a year ago. It had been off my report for one solid year, and I finally took a break from all this. I decided I didn't even want to look at a credit report for about 6 months. And boy, was that a mistake. I cannot do that. And this is what happened. Now, this has nothing to do with the criminals. It happens to do with the credit agencies, which is a whole different issue. I would like to go after them if I could.
Talk to Ms. Pellegrini. She can come back and talk to us about that.
I collect articles. There's only been two successful lawsuits against them, and it's not so much that the crime, the money amount is so much. It's what it does to your credit rating, because they go by the point system. It's only $150. I've bought lots of things. $150 lowered my credit rating, and it had been off for a year. It's back on. The same jewelry store sold it to two. The same thing, the same month, to two different collection agencies. Now, I called them up and I said, you knew it was fraud. You even wrote me a separate letter. And it's illegal. And I called up all the credit agencies and I told them that they were buying an illegal, it had an affidavit of fraud against it, that it was fraud and they were buying fraud. And I got some nasty phone calls, very nasty, from these agencies. And believe it or not, I called up Experian, I think it was Experian or Equifax. I don't know which one this one was. Oh, it was Equifax. Equifax. And they actually put me to a higher level in their fraud department, whatever that is. I was only at the second level or something. And they immediately took it off my account.
Karen, I think Representative Prozanski had a question for you.
Yeah.
Karen, I do have a question. I also have a question for Cheryl. Just from what I just heard, it sounds to me those credit collection companies should be getting some type of intervention from DOJ on consumer fraud. I thought that if someone was trying to collect a debt that is not warranted, in this case where you actually had fraud, then they themselves are committing a crime.
I believe they were. I turned them in. That's how I got my connection with Jan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Prozanski, I think the issue here is that there is an entire secondary market for collectible debts. I talked to a representative of the collector, Mr. Marquis. He represents the Oregon Collectors Collections Association. They're aware of the problem. I think what happens, according to him sometimes, is that a debt will be listed. It will be passed along from the original merchant to the first collection company. The first collection company will get will receive some notice that debt is actually the product of an identity theft. the collection company will stop collection efforts, but then will later sell its portfolio of uncollected accounts to another collection company who doesn't necessarily pick up on the identification of that uncollectible debt that the first company made, and will then reinstitute collection efforts. I think the industry is aware of the problem. This, again, just came up in the context of that identity theft working group that we've all been participating in. And I would say that you all may well see something to address that, perhaps next session.
Mr. Chair, if I can follow
yes.
up. Cheryl, I guess in hearing Karen's story as to what's happened, it seems like all these multiple number of individuals that have been using her identity, I don't see by adding the identity theft to the RICO statute that law enforcement would be going against those individuals unless you're able to show those other requirements for a organized crime. Aren't we really talking about the limitation of going after who was actually, let's say, received it, either stole it directly from her or other people in the line that then went out to resell it over and over, that was in the let's say in the business of actually profiting from that, as compared to someone that's just maybe purchased once? Or are we saying that anyone up and down the line is going to be able to be charged with RICO based on their use of her identity?
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, I think the answer to that is yes.
Okay.
That what this would enable us to do is not just to pursue the first person, but all of those subsequent people, whether or not, I mean, that an enterprise can be a tacit enterprise or it can be an actual enterprise. I mean, by virtue of the fact that people are using a common stolen identity to perpetrate crimes, I think that would qualify them for prosecution under RICO.
So, Mr. Chair, if I can
yes,
follow up.
If I can say, at the very least, it would enable us on the civil side to sue all of those individuals and bring them all in under one case.
Okay. So under that scenario, though, then we're looking on the criminal side, that individual could be charged with identity theft, whatever theft they commit, as to whether the value of that is, up to whatever level that would be, and also they could be charged RICO both criminally and potentially civilly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, that in theory that's true. I think that how it would work out, and the reason that my section of the Attorney General's office typically will bring a civil RICO action is because while there is enough to establish an enterprise and victims and possibly assets, there may not be enough to make up each separate individual person's list of predicate offenses. We could make up two beyond to a preponderance,
mm-hmm.
but there would not be enough to sustain a criminal prosecution.
Okay.
So I think as a practical matter, prosecutors would exercise discretion as to what the best avenue would be to address the crime or to stop the activity.
Further questions? Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate
thank you very much.
Coming down, and appreciate hearing your personal testimony. Kelly Skye.
Good afternoon, Chair Williams, members of the committee. Kelly Skye with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And we oppose this bill. I really can't present an argument as to why identity theft shouldn't be put in the RICO statute. As I mentioned earlier, criminal trespass is a predicate offense, so there's no reason that identity theft shouldn't be. Our concern is with the underlying identity theft statute, and there are a number of bills in the legislature this session that attempt to alter the identity theft statute, and our concern is that it is extremely overbroad and it is being used by prosecutors in circumstances for which we don't believe the legislature intended it to be, and that is not it's not always used for crimes such as you've heard about here today. The actual identity theft statute only requires that someone possess, transfer, create, utter, or convert someone else's personal identification with the intent to deceive. So there doesn't have to be an intent to defraud or to make money off of the transaction. Merely, it can merely be an intent to deceive. So, for example, if you're sitting in a bar and somebody's trying to pick up on you and you just are trying to get rid of them, and you write down a fake name on a napkin, fake name and telephone number, and hand it to that person, sure, give me a call. Technically, you fit within the statute. In discussing this, the identity theft statute with other members of our organization, somebody mentioned that they check out books from the library under Charles Darwin, technically a violation of the identity statute. So that's one of our major concerns, is that you need only have the intent to deceive. There, one of the bills that's circulating in the legislature is Senate Bill 308, which seeks to expand the identity theft statute to not require that the person actually possess anything physical with this person's identification, that it can just be a mere verbal representation. So if you give someone a false name for any purpose, so long as your purpose is to deceive that person as to who you are, you don't want them to know who your real identity is, you are guilty of identity theft. And we frequently see these added as an additional charge in every forgery or theft case. We also frequently see them charged in circumstances that are really what's covered under the furnishing false information to a police officer. So you've got your standard person who's approached by a police officer and they give a false name. Those are now being charged as identity thefts in many jurisdictions. That's taken what the legislature passed as a misdemeanor and elevated it to a C felony for giving a false name to a police officer. So those are places, those are reasons that we're concerned. Senate Bill 52 seeks to create the crime of aggravated identity theft, which probably would address many of the concerns that were brought up here earlier. Our concern, again, there is that you are, again, expanding, increasing the crime to a Class B felony if the person has two or more prior convictions. So if they've used a false name on two or more occasions, they then have a presumptive prison sentence attached to that. So while there are many people who commit the crime of identity theft who deserve the presumptive prison sentence, our concern is that the language of the statute is so overbroad that prosecutors are capturing people who were never intended to be included within the statute. There is House Bill 3481, which seeks to create a task force on identity theft, and perhaps this is a vehicle which can be used to achieve what we're asking for, which is to have all of these identity theft issues considered together so that everybody's on the same page as to exactly what conduct it is that that is the goal of punishing, and how this statute is to be used, so that it's not continually expanded in our fervor to prosecute people who commit such crimes as you heard about earlier, but that it's not overused. So that's simply the testimony that I wanted to present today, is that we would just ask that you consider the underlying crime identity theft. We don't necessarily have an objection to it being placed in the racketeering statute if you consider the crime itself and making sure that it's narrowly tailored to achieve the results that you're looking for.
Thank you. Are there questions for Ms. Sky? We're a quiet group today, gentlemen. Is it just because it's Friday afternoon? Well,
it's all the noise outside.
It's all the noise outside, right? It's the horn honking. Kelly, I want to talk through the position that you folks have taken on the bill. You don't have a problem with identity theft being included in the RICO statute, but you don't like the underlying crime and the way it's currently being used. So unless we fixed it, you're going to remain opposed to the bill. Is that right?
Right. We're opposed to any expansion of the identity theft statute that's not narrowly tailored to achieve the means that that are being presented as the reasons for those bills. We see the abuse on our end, and it's that abuse of the statute or overuse of the statute that we're concerned about. It's not we're not concerned about the use of the statute to prosecute the people for whom it was actually meant to prosecute.
I guess I want to explore the statement that you've made about the abuse of the statute in the circumstances that you've described. When someone has committed a forgery, a forgery claim, and they've used, false information or a forgery event, and they've used false information, why wouldn't that be an appropriate additional charge?
In some cases, it may be. Our concern is that you're taking a misdemeanor forgery, something that has for years been a misdemeanor forgery, and that conduct may still only be of a misdemeanor level. It may be that someone finds a check for $25 and somehow changes the name so that it reflects their own name or alters that check in some way, so that they're not actually it's not a pattern of conduct. It's just one incidence of forgery. Then that misdemeanor forgery now has become a C felony under this identity theft statute. Now, if the person were to steal the whole checkbook and would be distributing checks throughout and presenting themselves as the individual who owned the checkbook, then that certainly is the kind of conduct that identity theft seeks to punish. But in not all cases, it doesn't have to be a real person for purposes of the identity statute. So if you give a false name, it's a fictitious person. You're not injuring anybody. You're not defrauding anybody. You're not causing damage to anyone's credit report. You're not. You don't even have to be gaining any monetary advantage, and that's why I use the Charles Darwin example. There's no intent to defraud in that situation. It's merely an intent. There are many public officials who use false names for different purposes because they don't want their identities revealed. And in doing that, they use a fictitious name. They're not harming anybody else, and that falls within the identity theft statute.
But the likelihood of being prosecuted for using Charles Darwin to check out books at the public library is pretty small. I mean, I understand your point where if it's not theft of an identity if it's not a real person that you're stealing it from. I mean that's a point that would be worthy of consideration. If you're it may be forgery, it may be giving false information to a police officer, it may be a lot of other things that already are a crime. But if I say I'm Kelly Sky when I'm not, that's using someone's real identity. If I say I'm somebody who doesn't exist, that seems to me to be a more difficult question. The problem that I think we're faced with is we're not currently in a position, nor do we have a bill, I don't think, in our possession that really addresses that issue, and yet we're struck with this real challenge of a rampant problem with organized really well-organized rings of people who are engaged in the criminal activity of identity theft with the kind of impacts that you heard testified here today. And based on the email that I receive and the comments that are made to me while I'm in town halls and the experiences that I've had in my own private legal practice assisting clients who have had these sort of situations develop in their life, I mean, it's far from an isolated occurrence. And I think we're left in the position of while we might be able to nitpick the separate identity theft statute to some degree, I'm nervous about not giving law enforcement the tools that they might need to effectively prosecute people who are engaged in the kind of identity theft that is so rampant and includes the sale of the information over and over again to different groups of people engaged truly in a criminal organization associated with this information. So that's the challenge that I think that we're faced with. You move towards your microphone, Representative.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I will jump into this, even though it's an area of activity I had no prior experience with at all. But it was very interesting to hear the dialogue going on you were having with the witness. Ms. Sky, is there validity to the concept of identity theft as a crime, apart from the components of fraud and forgery and the pieces that are being perpetrated when that's going on? Or would you say that we don't need an identity theft statute at all and that we ought to rely on the criminalization of those component pieces?
Well, now we've gone beyond what I thought through for today. And, you know, that would take some thought, and I guess that was my point in coming here today, is that that this all requires a bit of thought, and that we would like for the committee to know exactly what it is that you're putting into the racketeering statute. Because there are so many bills floating around that apply to identity theft, I don't think that there's a way for you to know exactly what it is that you're putting into the racketeering statute, because once you put this identity theft statute number into the racketeering statute, then all of these other bills that are floating around that may change it, change what you've done. And so that was my point. There most likely is validity to having an identity theft statute, but we firmly believe that it's overbroad at this point, and in this session there are bills that seek to expand it even further. And I don't think that there's a need to have a bill that covers the intent to deceive only. If it's an intent to deceive only and it's a fictitious name, who's being harmed and where is the crime? And there may be circumstances in which that is a crime and somebody is harmed, but there's nothing in this bill that limits a prosecutor from charging someone where it isn't. And what you need to understand is that we see those cases, and they're frequently poor people and people who come into contact with the criminal justice system for some other reason, and this gets tacked on as an extra charge. And those are our primary concerns.
Okay. Follow up if I could, Mr. Chair. Given that the relating to clause here is relating to racketeering, it would seem that we couldn't take this change off in the direction that you're suggesting, which is a narrowing of the identity theft statute. Are there bills that will come, as far as you know the process and you're tracking, to this committee that will, even though their thrust may now be to broaden the definition of what is an identity theft, that would be vehicles in which one could consider the concerns that you're raising of whether the statute is in some respects now overly broad?
Well, the bill that I mentioned, House Bill 3481, and I think this was just recently dropped, if I'm correct, this seeks to create a task force on identity theft, and perhaps that's a bill that can do what I'm talking about. It will create a vehicle for the discussion that we would like to see happen.
What does it say? What's its relating clause, Kelly?
Relating to identity theft, appropriating money, and declaring an emergency.
Yeah.
The task force shall conduct a study to identify ways in which personally identifying information is unlawfully obtained. So it looks like it would study the ways that it can be prevented,
mm-hmm.
As well as the ways that it can be prosecuted. And
we have a number of other bills in the committee with broad enough relating clauses that if it's the committee's desire to go down this road, we can do that. Representative Przanski indicated to me that he won't oppose this bill, but would welcome the discussion. I would like, frankly, to have the discussion, because to the extent that we're in a continuing effort of actually trying to sort of develop a criminal justice system that can afford to pay as it goes, A lot of broadening, you know, is probably not going to be on our financial agenda, even if it's things we want to do. At the same time, I think it's appropriate that, you know, we make sure that we've tailored these things to be used the way we've intended them to be used, and not to be used outside that intent. And I'm happy to engage in that discussion. What I really feel in this situation today, however, is that because of the nature of this bill, and the significant problem that we know we're having at a much higher level of criminality with respect to the organized efforts of identity theft, that I don't want to miss the opportunity, frankly, to move forward and place this in the RICO statute. And that's my own view.
Right. And Mr. Chair, and I concur with that it seems to me that it is the trafficking in false identities that is the most pernicious aspect of that area of activity, so that this bill really goes to really the core of what the concept in my mind of what identity theft is about. This is a necessary piece, even though there may be validity in the point that the underlying statute itself may be stated in an overly broad way.
Right. Okay.
And Chair Williams, I would agree with you on that. I just wanted to. It's hard for us not to take a position on a bill as this when we don't agree with the underlying crime.
And I understand that, and I appreciate you making us aware of your concerns about the way the underlying crime is being used. And I think that's a conversation that appears to have some interest to the committee, and we may have an opportunity to talk further about that as some of these other bills move through the process. But that horn signals the time to finish your testimony.
What time?
So I'm going to close the public hearing on this bill, on House Bill 2119, and the tone change indicates that it's time to move into work session on House Bill 2119.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
I will move House Bill 2119 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson moves House Bill 2119 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Hearing none. Jane, if you'd call the roll.
Okay. Ackerman?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Barker?
Excused.
Jensen?
Here. Yes.
Trimble?
Excused.
McPherson?
Aye.
Kazansky?
Excused.
Shetterly?
Excused.
Shetterly?
Aye. House Bill 2119 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative McPherson, would you like to carry it?
I will do so.
Okay. Thank you. That concludes our business for the afternoon committee. Appreciate you hanging with us through Friday. We are adjourned.
I've been sitting here trying to fantasize the type.